From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, behind Rick Perry's oops, what really caused the debate gaffe that may have ended his presidential run?
Everybody knew there was something that was off, that he wasn't on his game, that he can do better than this.
The fight over the future of the University of Texas.
Well, they're battling over who is going to run UT. Is it going to be the leadership of the university, or is it going to be the governor?
And how about those Cowboys? The untold story of America's team.
Yeah, if you're a fan, I'm going to give you a lot of information about this football franchise. But if you're a hater, I'm going to tell you why you're a hater.
Support for Texas Matters is provided by the Institute of Texan Cultures, putting the Lone Star State's people, products, and ideas known around the world on display with the exhibit Made in Texas, now open. More at texancultures.com.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With less than 40 days before the end of the presidential election, those primary days seem like ancient history. And for a while there, Governor Rick Perry seemed like the guy who was going to capture the conservative voters, bundle up those pro-business dollars, and ride a wave of Texas economic success to win the GOP nomination. But it didn't work out that way, and some people say it had something to do with this debate gaffe.
It's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
You need five.
Oh, five. Okay. So commerce, education, and
Texas Tribune reporter Jay Root has written a book about Perry's presidential run called Oops, a diary from the 2012 campaign trail. He writes Perry's mental lapse was caused by a lack of sleep.
I think that he was not healthy, really. He was suffering from pretty severe sleep deprivation. I report on the sleep apnea that was diagnosed during the campaign. They brought in sleep specialists. There was sort of this frenzied attempt to get him back sleeping again. And there was sleep apnea. He also had a nerve problem in his foot that was bothering him, causing him a lot of pain and keeping him up at night. And once those issues sort of got better, he was able to exercise and get back into the gym and get more energy. The campaign feels like he started performing better, but then it was just too late. The damage had been done.
How was the relationship with the press, with the Perry campaign? Could they communicate this, or was this kept under wraps?
No, it was kept under wraps. One advisor told me that there were, he thought about, thinking about, would this be a good thing to get out there? But they felt like, while Perry was still in the race, that it would seem like excuse making, and so there was a decision not to to bring it out publicly.
But I mean, it's better to say he's had these problems, health problems. Everyone's had health problems, than to have him be, being portrayed as just this person who's just doesn't have the mental wattage to even perform in a debate.
Right.
And you and I have been covering Rick Perry forever, and we know that he's better than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I wrote most of this book is my diary, and it's kind of, you're taken along for the ride of a presidential campaign that begins out, you're thinking, oh my God, this guy's going to be the nominee. We're going to be in Tampa in the summer of next year and covering his acceptance speech. And then, you hit a few bumps, and then you fall like a hole in the pavement and the car went in. I mean, it just was a spectacular collapse. And for those of us who have watched him for all of these years, everybody knew there was something that was off, that he wasn't on his game, that he can do better than this. Sure, debating is not his strong suit. Everybody knows that. But this was something altogether different. This was a level of underperforming or performing below expectations that nobody saw coming.
the book? Is this lessons learned and now next time we're going to do better?
I do think that there is some aspect of that. You know, you've heard Perry and his advisors say that one of the best ways to get prepared for a presidential campaign is one that you've already done and not been successful at. So you sort of learn what works and what doesn't work. Perry has seen what rock bottom looks like, and there's no reason to think that he would be that off his game again. I think one of the dangers, though, is that if there are, I mean, everybody has gaffes. President Obama has had some gaffes. Mitt Romney has had some gaffes, but they're not known as gaffe machines necessarily. Rick Perry was a gaffe machine in the 2012 primary, and so the danger for him is that that's kind of a narrative that's built up about him. And so if he does, you know, he could come out strong and then, you know, he could maybe be in a high-profile moment and get the name of something wrong. And then there could be sort of this there-he-goes-again phenomenon. So I think he would have to be very mindful of that and take steps to avoid that.
You said he saw rock bottom, but he also saw the top of the mountain, and he liked it. He would like to be back there again.
Makes a joke. He often makes this joke that he reminds people that he was the front runner at one time, and that was the most exhilarating 3 hours of his life. But that's a joke, obviously. But you did get the sense that he liked it. He loved being out there. Loves campaigning. Is good at it. Is very good at the retail campaigning. I mean, he's one of the best one-on-one retail, as we say, retail politicians that I've ever seen.
Romney campaign, not looking too good in the polls. There's still some weeks ahead. Who knows what's going to happen? But if Barack Obama does win re-election, then Rick Perry could be back at it. And I've heard some rumblings that on November the 7th that they could start the ground game on that very day.
Not so much a ground game, but just more lining up potential supporters and, you know, putting out feelers and boosting your profile. But keep in mind, we're going into a potentially raucous legislative session that begins in January. There's also, before 2016, there's 2014. And 2014, there'll be a governor's race. Will Rick Perry be in it? And who would be running against him, if anybody? I'm not sure he would get a free ride. I don't know. It's hard to know. But you know, if he were to run for office, run for governor again, and get elected to a 4-year term and served it out, that would be a total of 18 years in that office. I mean, that you basically would have people who were born when Rick Perry was sworn in as governor, would have gone all the way through high school, and there would never have been any other governor.
And then they'd be old enough to vote for him.
And then they would be old enough to vote for him for, I guess, a fifth term. That would be, what, 22 years, or 20, yeah.
So you don't have this feeling that Rick Perry wants to have another race so he can redeem himself.
You certainly hear that talk around here. I mean, that's the kind of inside the Beltway chatter that he, you know, he needs to prove something, whatever. I have not asked him that. I don't know if he would be candid about that, if you know, that he would probably hold his cards a little closer to the vest on that. But I think it. Around here, certainly around Austin, the idea that he would run for president is fine with everybody. Running for governor, that's where you're looking at, like, internal statewide conflict. I mean, you have a very ambitious Attorney General, Greg Abbott, who is really a beloved figure in the Republican grassroots. That's one of the things that I learned at the GOP convention in Tampa. They really like Greg Abbott. The same people, the same coalition that Ted Cruz put together for his winning Senate race seem to be behind Greg Abbott for whatever he wants to do. And he's, you know, that they see, you know, even though he's been Attorney General for a long time, they see him as a fresh face. And there is sort of this desire to get some new blood in there. And I think Ted Cruz is the embodiment of that.
Jay Root is a reporter for the website texastribune.org. He covered Rick Perry's failed presidential campaign and has written a book about its ups and downs called Oops, A Diary from the 2012 Campaign Trail. There are few major institutions in Texas that have the ability to reach the entirety of this massive state. One of them is the University of Texas. The Austin campus is more or less a neighbor to the state capitol. It's a leading public university for scientific research and academic achievement. But tuition is skyrocketing. Enrollment is bursting at the seams. Students are graduating with massive debt loads, while questions are being asked about the actual worth of a college degree these days. Does the school need to be reformed? The latest issue of Texas Monthly says there's a battle over the future of UT. Paul Burka is the Texas Monthly senior editor and wrote the article, Storming the Ivory Tower.
Well, they're battling over who is going to run UT. Is it going to be the leadership of the university, or is it going to be the governor, the governor's office, and his allies? And I think that's really what this is all about. The governor has immersed himself deeply into the running of the University of Texas, and so there's there have been some decisions made and some statements made in which various regents, including Chairman Powell, have made policy statements about what they think the University of Texas should do in the future that are not consistent with the mission of UT to be a university of the first class.
You would think that Rick Perry had enough on his hands to do running the state of Texas and running Texas A&M, but now he also has to run UT?
Apparently so, yes. And, you know, man, I think Perry has some positions that are reasonable. I think one of them is that tuition is too expensive. The cost needs to come down, and he won that battle. And UT's tuition is going to be frozen for the next couple of years. But I think in the long term, the question is, for example, again, the chairman of the Board of Regents believes that UT should increase enrollment. He would increase it by 10% a year over the next 4 years. Well, if that happens, you've increased it to 56,000, and they'll probably be giving classes in Memorial Stadium. Can the university infrastructure stand the strain of increased enrollment? And then he also wants to cut tuition in half, which would make it almost impossible to sustain the funding of the faculty at current level.
One of the big elements of criticism is that UT has become this cloister or ivory tower where this esoteric research is being done that really has no practical value. It's just there to entertain the curiosity of these egghead professors.
Well, I think that's a general criticism of higher ed, and not just UT. And there are different kinds of research.
I mean, over at Texas A&M, they're figuring out how to make better tasting beef jerky. That's important.
But purple carrots.
In purple carrots and things like that.
Yeah.
But at UT, they're...
But I think the big argument against the research is the journal articles that professors write that no one reads except other professors. So, you know, I think there is a certain elitism in higher ed that the public instinctively is suspicious about and has real questions. Plus, we have information from various sources now that students are not learning in their years in college. So there's a question of whether the colleges are really doing their jobs right.
And then there's the business school, the McCombs School, named after Red McCombs, the billionaire car salesman of San Antonio. He had had something to say about this battle royale, Daryl Royale, on the campus.
He wrote a letter to Powell, the chairman whom he obviously knows from San Antonio, and said that there was too much infighting going on in the board, and that he hoped that the board would, you know, return to its governance role, you know, and support the university. And I think that had a big effect because the regents were running wild at that point. You know, there was a phrase that some of the big UT backers and donors used, which was the runaway regent. And some of these regents who came from the Texas Public Policy Foundation and other ideological roots, you know, there was a lot of concern about whether they were trying to take over the university and run it with their views, which were presumably also Governor Perry's views.
So why should those of us who are not on tenure track at UT really be concerned about this battle over the culture?
Well, I think the reason that you should be concerned is that higher ed is an extremely vital part of Texas and of the things that state government does. And I mean, you know, they have these statistics they quote that for every dollar that is spent on research at UT, it returns $18 to the economy. But I do think that, you know, having two or three great universities in the state, you know, is really important. That you know, a lot of incredible things has come out of UT and A&M over the years. You know, great research, but just also a lot of really smart people, you know, who are essentially the future leaders of Texas. And so, you know, I think it's extremely important to have great universities. I don't think, you know, not every university can be great. You know, when you have places like UT and A&M and Rice, which is my alma mater, that really adds a great deal to the state and a lot of brain power. And I think that's important.
Paul Burka is the senior editor for Texas Monthly. He wrote the article about the debate over reforming UT called Storming the Ivory Tower. It's in the current issue of Texas Monthly. Another institution that every Texan has something to say about is the Dallas Cowboys. It's a safe bet that everyone in the state has something in their wardrobe that salutes the blue and silver pokes. Author Joe Nikpotowski says the Cowboys are more than just a team. He's undertaken a cultural exploration of the five-time Super Bowl champs and has written the book, The Dallas Cowboys, The Outrageous History of the Biggest, Loudest, Most Hated, Best Loved Football Team in America.
The Dallas Cowboys are not just a football franchise in the National Football League. It really is an institution, and it's one of these lifestyle things that go a long way in explaining who we are as Texans and what this place called Texas is all about. I mean, this is the big deal. I mean, as far as my quest of trying to figure out Texans in Texas for the last 35 some odd years, I've not tackled a bigger subject. And it really is this big, big thing that transcends sports. It really talks about who we are as a culture.
This is not like a book of statistics about who caught which pass and things like that.
No, this is really something that transcends football. And I've been trying to tell people, yeah, if you're a fan, I'm going to give you a lot of information about this football franchise. But if you're a hater, I'm going to tell you why you're a hater. And really, it's more about this cultural definition. And I've spent most of my writing career looking at music as a way to understand culture. And I've been doing it long enough to understand the power of using food as a way to understand culture. But this is kind of my big swing at trying to explain sports as an identifying marker in our culture. And when it comes to Texas, there's no sport bigger than football. And when it comes to football, there's no institution as big and wide-ranging and symbolic as the Dallas Cowboys. And sorry, Aggies, sorry, Longhorns, and sorry, Houston Texans. there's nothing that is globally significant as this football team. It's a brand now that's known not just throughout Texas and the nation. It's a global brand. And when you look at that blue star with the white outline, that's right up there with Coca-Cola as this logo that's instantly recognizable. And you see it all around the world. So that's what I've been spending the last 3.5 years drilling into, is trying to figure out why, and, you know, basically trying to answer this question: why is the most valuable franchise in American sports located in Dallas, Texas? Well, I can tell you right now, it couldn't have been anywhere else. And it's really a combination of people, ideas, want to drive, that this franchise is basically tells the story of the NFL, the National Football League, which since the Cowboys started in 1960, back then the National Football League was a professional football league, the premier professional football league. Today, it's probably the biggest entertainment in America. And the Cowboys have been in there all the way, even today.
Well, the Cowboys, I mean, at least during the Tom Landry era, was, you know, a symbol of excellence. And to me, that was like the big thing about it. Like, this was a tightly run organization with this highly disciplined and really thoughtful analysis of how to win. And you had people who were able to execute, like Staubach. And then again, with Troy Aikman, you know, you just couldn't help but admire their, you know, performance. But it's not like that anymore.
Well, you know, football, the game, is at the center of all this. And certainly one-loss records matter. Super Bowls matter. And what's interesting about this story, it's how these front office people invented this team out of whole cloth. I mean, they were an expansion franchise, and it was, yes, it was the coach Tom Landry from Mission, Texas. It was the general manager and president, Texas Schramm, Tex Schramm Jr., who wasn't born in Texas but went to the University of Texas. His daddy was from San Antonio, and he moved out to Los Angeles and became a stockbroker. But it was Tex Schramm, and it was Clint Merkerson, the owner, who at the time was one of the richest men in the world. The odd thing is, in 1960, you not only had Clint Merkerson Jr. starting up a franchise in Dallas, Texas for football, but you also had Lamar Hunt, who was another son of one of the big four of Texas Oil, another one of the richest men on earth, and they both had Football Jones, and they both started pro teams in Dallas in the same year. And from that, it really informs everything today. But when I look at the Cowboys, I did kind of back off, and Clint Merkerson's ownership defines one regime, the first regime. And it's exactly what you said. This was a team based on excellence, style, a look, really innovative. I mean, the first team to use computers in scouting. Texas Stadium, the first made-for-football stadium in the modern era, and is actually the first football stadium made for television. Tex Schramm saw the future of this sport as a television sport, like no other sport. Now, the second regime, which is defined by the owner, Jerry Jones, may have been very successful at first. I mean, within 5 years, you have Jerry Jones, the owner, and Jimmy Johnson, the coach, come in, and they're winning Super Bowls. I mean, and under Jones's leadership and ownership, 3 Super Bowl championships in 4 years. But since 1996, you have a very average football team with like a .500 record. No great shakes. I mean, we should be talking about them like we talk about the Tampa Bay Buccaneers or the St. Louis Rams. But what Jones has done as an owner was monetize the team and increase the value of the team at a time when the whole league monetized. And again, the NFL really transitioned from a football league into the biggest entertainment in America. 18 of the top 20 viewed television programs in 2011 were NFL football games, and the majority of those involved the Dallas Cowboys. So this is it's really a business story. It's about sports transitioning from sport, a rich man's toy, which is what, you know, owning a football team was in 1960, to a business, and a very, very successful business. And in that respect, Jerry Jones has been a visionary. They may not have been very successful as a general manager, but as an owner, he has increased value and made the team still part of the conversation. And right before this season, the NFL released a survey. The most popular team in the NFL are the Dallas Cowboys, number one in merchandise, most hated team of all the football teams. All these really speak to basically the selling of this idea or this franchise. And again, Dallas has been in front all the way.
Well, it seems to me that the Dallas Cowboys have kind of been America's avatar.
Well, it's true that when you say America's avatar, that's putting it a lot nicer than America's team, which was what NFL Films dubbed the Cowboys in 1978. And it stuck with them. And, you know, people grumble, why is America's team in Dallas? Well, they had the coolest-looking uniforms. They had the cheerleaders. There were already cheerleaders in the NFL. Baltimore Colts had cheerleaders. The Washington Redskins had a band and a pep squad. But when the Cowboys really articulated the cheerleaders in the 1970s, and that coincides with the opening of Texas Stadium, they became America's sweetheart. They made a made-for-television movie that instantly became the most popular made-for-television movie ever. So it's all these elements that really inform why we're talking about Dallas and the Cowboys today. And I really think that so much of this story is how the city reflects on the team and how the team reflects on the city. And I don't think that there's a more powerful symbiotic relationship in professional sports anywhere in the United States. And I mean, the Cowboys story is about, when they started, they were the first professional sports franchise in the segregated South. So it's about segregation. So by the end of the 70s, with Captain America, Roger Staubach quarterbacking, I mean, you can't invent an All-American hero as clean-cut and as straight up and straightforward as Roger Staubach. Or Coach Landry, who was really Tom Landry was an innovative X's and O's genius when he came to the Cowboys and was so far ahead of his time. So it's all the, you know, it ain't bragging if it's true, and it really is true about the Cowboys, and there's a reason why they are where they are today, despite the fact the record's so-so at best.
Joe Potoski is the author of The Dallas Cowboys, The Outrageous History of the Biggest, Loudest, Most Hated, Best Loved Football Team in America. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past Texas Matters programs on our website at tpr.org. And you can download the free podcast from iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.
Support for Texas Matters is provided by the Institute of Texan Culture's Made in Texas exhibit.